This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay. I hereby call this meeting to order. Today is Monday, November 9th, 2020. Before we begin, please remember to append to your Zoom name with the proper division qualifications and the V if you are a voting member, just like we did in the previous meeting. Could the offices of assemblies please begin the roll call?
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to go alphabetical order. Matthew Bulch.
I'm here.
Ruth Marinkovich. Karina Barras. Hannah Bidiger Curtis.
Here.
Allison Bidgerano. Mila Kantar, Martique Chatterjee, Amanda Cirilla, Peyton Cole,
here,
Hannah Cole,
here,
Nicola Danev,
here,
Jordan Dotzel,
here,
Cody Duell.
Here.
Madeline Keith.
Here.
Kavya Krishnan.
Here.
Casey Laurent.
Here.
Stephanie Lopez. Tim Littermoser.
Here.
Ryan Maloney. Catherine Masters. Christine Oenewa?
Here.
Okay. Matt Schaffler?
Here.
Emery Shonley?
Here.
Matthew Sturgeon?
Here.
Paul Vintage? Marvin Wayne? Meredith Welch?
Here.
And Heidi Hsu.
Okay, do we have quorum?
Yes, we do.
Just one. Okay, and what is it? I'm sorry, what is the total?
Let me count really quick.
Because I have 16, if that's correct.
That's right.
Okay, so the total number of voting members today is 16. Please remember that for all resolutions or votes on resolutions, these require an absolute majority of all the seated voting members, so that would be 13 people. For all other motions, a majority today shall require 9 votes, simple majority, or if it's the case of a supermajority, that would be 11 votes. So please keep that in mind for today. Nick, you had a point of order.
Yeah, just wanted to put on the record that Ariel is here. She entered during the roll call.
This should just be a roll call for the voting members. So is Ariel a voting member? Okay.
I do not have that
note. I entered, I think, after roll call, and I'm a voting member, by the way.
Allison. Okay. So were you weren't counted in the voting call, so the total should be 17 then. Okay. So that's 17. Again, the absolute majority is still 13, a simple majority is 9, and the supermajority is 12. Okay. If there are no further questions on that, then we will move on to the next order of our agenda, which is the approval of the meeting minutes for Monday, October 26th. Would someone like to make a motion? Motion to approve. Nick?
Yeah, motion to approve the minutes.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seeing no objections, the motion carries. So the meeting minutes are approved. We will now move on to unfinished business from our last meeting, which is resolution 3. Would someone like to make a motion untabling this resolution? Nick?
Motion to untable resolution 3.
Is there a second?
I second.
Okay, the motion has been properly seconded. Nick, could you please restate the resolution? And if you could please share your screen so we can see it.
Absolutely. So let me just share the link with everyone. Actually, yeah, right there. And let me get the screen share up. Okay. So the resolution comes in two parts. The main part is the actual resolution, and then we have a supplement where we kind of explain the reasoning behind what's said in the resolution. I would like to note that I sent an email to the voting members that I would be submitting an amendment to the resolution. The amendment is to strike a part of it because the CJC is actually hosting a town hall. So this entire section from line 18 to 23 is no longer necessary because the university will indeed be hosting a town hall as this resolution asks of them. So generally, I'm just going to do a quick walkthrough. Again, I know last time we did it, but it was in 2 minutes. So I'm just going to try to explain everything in it. And to do that, I'm actually going to be using the supplement because it includes the reasoning. So the first thing, the GPSA, in my opinion, should oppose removal of the ability to question the witnesses directly. I think it's very important to allow the JCC or the Respondents Code Counselor, as they will be called in the new code, to speak on behalf of their client and to also question people in the hearing, because a lot of students might not have English as their first language, might feel uncomfortable speaking on their own, so they might need these Respondents Code Counselors to actually conduct that for them. And I've spoken to the JCCs, and they came to our meeting, and as we know, they don't do this very often, but sometimes it is necessary. So I think it's important to retain this in this code. Moreover, I think one of the really important things is that the JCC must remain independent from the OJA. Let me just put it in really simple terms. The OJA presses, and I'm not going to use the exact terminology that's in the code just for the sake of clarity, but the OJA is the office that presses charges against students. So imagine if you are being charged with something, and then also the office that charges you and adjudicates the process is also the office that's defending you. It just kind of seems a little unreasonable to me, a little unfair maybe, because I think the person representing you shouldn't be the person accusing you. I don't think the person accusing you should have a right to see your private conversations with the person defending you. This is regardless of whether you've done something or not. I think everyone deserves the right to fair representation. Then also, the clear and convincing evidence standard better advances the principles of fairness and due process. Everywhere in the world, especially in the American justice system and in the past at Cornell, we've had this principle of clear and convincing evidence and not preponderance of evidence. And I do want to make it very clear, this is very different from the Title IX standard. I fully agree that the Title IX standard should be a preponderance of evidence, but I think for all cases that are not Title IX, which is what we're talking about right now, the standard of proof should be clear and convincing evidence. We know from what we were told at our last GPSA meeting that about 90% of students get found guilty of whatever they're accused of by the university. So if the university had no trouble finding 90% of people guilty with the current standard, which is clear and convincing evidence, I can only imagine what's going to happen when we lower that standard. It's really going to put these students, who, remember, are mostly 18-year-olds that don't have any experience with the legal system, no prior convictions or anything like that, it's going to put them in a situation where they have to disprove lawyers, seasoned JDs that work for Cornell. So I think we're going to put students at a disadvantage if we don't advocate for this change that I'm suggesting here. And then also, this fourth point is the right of the accused to be afforded the assistance of an advisor is something that was stated in the previous code and is now kind of just removed from the code. So it is there, but it's not as explicit. Essentially, what's happening is the university doesn't have the obligation to notify them that they have the right to a counselor according to the new code. So I think that they should keep this clause. In fact, they should make it even more clear that students should be aware of the fact that they do get the right to be represented if they are charged with anything by the university. Also, the university council has suggested that all hearings are no longer public. I think this is a very scary precedent that we should not allow, because what happens when you have an office that is both the judicial office and the prosecutor and the defendant's office, all three in one, and also they have secret hearings? Sounds really unfair to me. I think if we allow students to have public hearings, then we allow accountability. We enforce accountability so that the university can't do whatever they want to, but they actually have to follow certain codes and guidelines, and the public can witness these. As I said, some things I support. I think that the GPSA should support the creation of the Office of the Complainants Code Counselor. So then there's the changes regarding temporary suspensions. I believe that we should be opposed to this, because what's happening in this new code, the old code allowed for temporary suspensions to be given by an independent hearing panel composed of members of the university community. So this is before you get found guilty of anything. This is when you're charged with something. This independent counsel could also temporarily suspend you. And there was a very high standard for that, rightfully so, because it's not a small deal to suspend someone from the university. You're essentially kicking them out of housing if they're an undergrad as well, and some grad students that live in housing. So what this new code proposes is, one, that the standard for imposing a temporary suspension is lowered, and two, and most concerningly, it takes away the right of the university community, so a student, an undergraduate, a graduate student, a faculty member, I believe, were on the previous committees. They're now changing that to be unilaterally decided by the vice president of student and campus life. I think that's giving way too much control and power to this office of the VP of SCL without even having proven that the student charged with anything is guilty. I think it's super important that we retain a way to suspend students that might be, you know, an extreme threat to campus safety or a concern to other students' safety, as it was before, in extraordinary circumstances and for the purpose of ensuring public order and safety. But I don't think we should just allow anyone to get suspended before they're even found guilty of anything and before at least have a panel decide about that. I think that they're also trying to make evidence essentially last forever, so remove the statute of limitations. In the past, the code said that if anything was older than a year, you couldn't be tried for it. And now this new code suggests that any time frame is okay. And I worry that evidence might deteriorate over time. It is this is a real thing. This is why the legal systems that we have around the world and in the United States have this statute of limitations, because the legal system acknowledges that evidence can deteriorate over time. And I don't think that Cornell should be an exception to that. I think evidence at Cornell deteriorates just as quickly as evidence anywhere else. I do think we should support the change in the proposed code that expand opportunities for resolution through restorative justice, so that we don't have to go into hearings, but maybe a one-on-one way to resolve issues should be promoted. I definitely agree with that. And the last thing this code of conduct will expand the university jurisdiction over all registered students, including fraternities and sororities, and that's totally okay. But it might not be appropriate for the university to have jurisdiction over off-campus conduct, except, very importantly, for as it is specified under the grave misconduct provision in the current code, which they're trying to change. So overall, this is kind of where I stand on this. This isn't just my opinion. So obviously, this resolution went through a committee. It was reviewed by the executive committee of the GPSA, but also it was worked on by several stakeholders. So it was a group of law students that helped interpret the past and current code, particularly A lot of people from the JCC's office helped out with this, and I think as graduate students, this fully represents our needs. So I understand that different constituencies on campus might have different opinions, but I think as graduate students, this kind of summarizes the vast majority of the comments that I've seen from our constituency, and I think it's a good stand to take as the GPSA, because this is something that will be affecting us directly. And also, I just wanted to thank the CJC committee members for coming to this meeting. So the CJC will be voting on this on the proposed code of conduct changes. So I really appreciate them coming here and hearing us out.
Thank you very much, Nick. The question is now before the assembly, and I open this up to formal debate. If anyone would like to speak in favor or against the resolution, please raise your hand now. I recognize Tim.
I believe Kat Huang had their hand raised before me.
So Kat is not a GPSA member, so I'd like to give precedence to GPSA members first before calling on non-members. So you go ahead first, and then I'll call her. Yeah.
Thank you. I just wanted to speak in support. I think Nick has very clearly laid out some concerns. I also think last week when we had the representative from the JCC here, she very clearly laid out, you know, their concerns from the defending student side. The point that most of these cases are sort of the university prosecuting a student, not necessarily conflicts between students, I think is highly relevant, especially with that preponderance of evidence point. And there was one of the independence of the JCC, you know, she spoke strongly on that point. And I think also her point that some of these changes were made sort of in anticipation, or some of these changes were proposed in anticipation of something from the Federal Department of Education that then didn't manifest the way that actually they expected, also seems like a very strong reason to just oppose those changes that are no longer necessary for that reason. So speaking in support.
Okay, I recognize Kat Wong.
Thank you so much, David. And Tim, thank you for trying to recognize me. I want to recognize that I am fully a guest in this body, so I'll try not to take up too much time. But my name is Kat. I am an undergrad student, and I'm a senior studying ILR. I'm here in my capacity as SA president. And beyond president of the SA, I'm also a student mediator with the Restorative Justice Program that handles code violation cases. So I'm very familiar with how undergrad students are affected by the code. I want to thank Nick for bringing this resolution. I agree with certain parts of it, but I do want to also recognize that the Student Assembly last semester, through our branch of the Office of the Student Advocate, they brought a different resolution that I think this resolution is in conflict with. And I appreciate Nick recognizing that the GPSA has its own certain constituency that they represent. But I also want to emphasize that the code of conduct disproportionately affects undergraduate students. So I am a little hesitant about the GPSA voting on a resolution that would affect the code of conduct without hearing from more undergraduate students. Just for a little context, if you look at the annual reports from the OJA, and I can send the links to those reports in a second, undergraduate students make up about 650 to 750 cases of the code violation cases a year. Graduate students only make up 10 to 20 every year. I think the specific numbers are like 16 and 19. And then on the undergraduate side is like 653 cases to 765 cases. So I do want to recognize that the undergraduate student assembly would disagree with certain parts of this resolution, specifically numbers three, numbers one of this, you know, the second half of this resolution, but we do completely agree with numbers six and number nine, which is approving the push towards restorative justice. But I just did want to recognize that the undergraduate student population does feel a little bit differently about these code changes and this resolution that you all are considering right now. I want to invite all of you to attend our student assembly meeting if you want to hear more about how undergraduates feel this Thursday. And again, thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
No worries. Cody, you're recognized.
Yeah, sorry about that. One thing that I wanted to bring up is that I'm not sure that some of the characterization in the beginning of this about the sort of public comment and the feedback process, I'm not sure that that's really an accurate reflection of how all of these changes were proposed and how everything came about. I, you know, was not personally involved in a lot of the development for these things, but, you know, I was a member of the UA during some of the more hectic discussions related to these things. And while I think there's a lot of really valuable content in this particular resolution, I'm not sure that it's quite accurate to characterize it as having such a very small amount of public feedback and public commentary, because this was a process that took quite a long time and had multiple different stages of feedback. And I think, you know, there are other people who would be more qualified to, you know, explain exactly what went on, but I just, I'm not quite sure that that's accurate.
Okay, Nick, you had your hand up. Would you like to speak?
Yes, thank you. So, just briefly, I'm also a member of the Codes and Judicial Committee on the UA. So the current proposed resolution has 23 comments publicly posted, and it's been up for over a month. So I do think there is a significant lack of knowledge about this among the graduate student community, and I think that the university did not make a great enough effort to kind of let us know of what's going on and get us involved. We've only gotten one email this year about it. And then to respond to what Kat said, I really do recognize that the Student Assembly last year voted on this. I don't know if the Student Assembly this year would agree. My understanding is that they voted last year in their last their last constituency and not as they are currently. But I also want to point out that while I recognize that the certain members of the Student Assembly might have different opinions, I do think that is the GPSA's responsibility to represent graduate and professional students, while also acknowledging that other constituencies at the university might have differing opinions. I just don't know where we would end up if we had to think about how every single one of our proposals, which is intended to benefit graduate students, would affect every single one person at Cornell that's not a graduate student. So I think the goal here is to, in fact, pass a resolution that would benefit the graduate and professional student community most, as we are elected by those people.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay, Kat, I'm sorry. Kat, you're recognized for your last follow-up there.
Yeah. Sure. Sorry, did other GPSA members want to go first? I don't want to take up time as I'm not a member.
So Tim also has his hand up. So I'm not sure if he was the one who just spoke. So Tim, if you'd like to go first, you can.
That was me who accidentally butted. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You recognize.
Still only speaking for, against, or can questions be asked at this time?
This is only formal discussion now. So only speaking for and against.
Okay, I will wait. Then.
Kat, you recognize.
Great. Thank you so much, David. Nick, I really appreciate you responding to my points. I hesitate at the idea that, like, the GPSA has to come at, you know, vote on something to further the interests of your constituency body when it would come at the expense of another constituency body. So I just sent a quick link in the chat. It's a link to the annual report from the Office of the Judicial Administrator, where if you go to page 11, you can see exactly how many of these cases are disproportionately borne by undergraduate students. Again, 650 to 750, as opposed to 10 to 20 cases of grad students. I do want to recognize the hard work that the JCCs do put into this process, but I strongly, strongly urge you all not to vote on this until you hear from possibly more undergraduate students. I know that this is completely your constituency. You're representing grad students here, but I would love if students were united in this. It is a student code of conduct, and I think it'd be great if we could keep thinking about how we can further the interests of both undergraduate and graduate students as we consider these conduct these code changes. Thank you.
Okay, is there any further discussion? If not, let's move into general discussion. Would anyone like to make any amendments or have any questions directed at Nick? So, Ariel, you recognize.
First, sorry, I raised my hand for the last section. Kat, thank you so much for being here.
I'm sorry, just a second. I want to make clear that during debate, all questions and addresses should be directed to the chair and not to any particular member.
Okay, so we can't ask Kat any questions. All right, never mind.
Is there any further discussion? Nick?
A motion to make an amendment to remove lines 18 through 23 from the resolution.
Sorry, can you just briefly state what those lines are?
Yes, they're calling for the university to organize a public forum about this. The reason I'm removing them is because the CJC will actually be hosting a forum on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. There will be an email about that tomorrow. I'm also going to mention it in the general announcements later. So since this criterion has already been met, I think it's redundant to have it in the resolution. So that's why I'm motioning to strike it.
Okay. Is there a second to the amendment?
Second.
Okay, there's been a second. Is there any objections? Seeing none, then by general consent, the resolution is thereby amended. And we now return to general discussion. Would anyone like to speak?
I just wanted to...
Tim, you're recognized.
Sorry, I did that twice. I apologize.
It's okay.
I guess this is a question for the author of the bill. I just wanted to clarify a point on point eight. As it had been mentioned that some of the other things specifically were about code of conduct and that does not apply to Title IX and that Title IX is a totally separate thing. I wanted to make sure just that it was said out loud that this point about statute of limitations also is explicitly not applying to Title IX things and is only applying to code of conduct things.
Nick, or can
I answer?
Go ahead. Yeah,
absolutely. Making it very explicit, nothing in this resolution applies to Title IX. So Title IX is a completely separate process. So none of this can in any way apply to Title IX.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? So I just want to make clear, there's a little bit of back and forth. I want to make clear that everyone is entitled to speak twice in discussion. So if you've already spoken twice, I'm sorry, I can't recognize you again. Would anyone like to speak who has not spoken yet? And just as a reminder that we are in general discussion, you can make amendments and you can ask questions directed to the sponsor. If not, is there a motion to the previous question? To vote. Nick?
Motioning to vote on this bill, on this resolution.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seeing no objections, we will now move into voting on the resolution. Voting members, if you are in favor of the resolution as so amended, please click yes. And if you are against, please click no. I'm going to do both at the same time, please.
And what about if we'd like to abstain?
Abstain, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to, I'm not going to call on them separately. So just affirmative and negative. And a reminder, only voting members should be voting. So if you weren't in the roll call, you shouldn't be voting. Okay, I'm going to give everyone one more minute. Okay, seeing no other votes, I read the result as 9 in favor, 1 against, and since there are 17 present, then that means 7 abstentions. So I'm afraid that the resolution does not pass. So because we require an absolute majority of 13 for a resolution to pass, all votes on resolutions. So if you're in the voting members, you had that was a chance. So
Point of order.
Yeah.
Yes. So the executive board of the GPSA was called in the voting members. So we were told that we can't vote on this. So just want to clarify, if so, then the majority number should be changed.
Well, the majority number is always the same because it's the majority of seated voting members, regardless of whether you are in attendance or not. So since we currently have 25 voting members, then the majority for all votes on resolutions should be 13. And since we only had 9, I think it, changing the number of the quorum does not make a difference on that. It should always be the same number. And so, and we had quorum because I read that we had 17 voting members. So the resolution still, unfortunately, does not pass. Okay, I think we now need to move on to our next order of business. Martha Pollack has just entered the assembly. Welcome. And she's the president of Cornell University, and she's come to speak before you today. So thank you for coming, and you are now recognized.
Thank you. I think I'm unmuted. Yes, you can hear me? Yes, great. Great. Well, thank you. It is really good to see all of you. I do have a number of updates, but I want to start with really a very heartfelt, enormous thank you to all of you for the incredible work that you've done in a year that really has been like no other. I'll say more about that in a moment. But since it's been a while since I was last here, it was last year in February, we were still living in the old normal, I do want to start by taking just a minute to recognize some very important leadership changes that have occurred since then. The first and the most relevant to you, and the one of which I know you're doubtless aware, is that you now have a new dean and advocate at Cornell. I am so delighted that Dean Catherine Bohr is serving as our new dean of the graduate school and vice provost of graduate education. I've known Dean Bohr almost since the day I got here. She isn't just a brilliant scholar and an outstanding mentor and a really exceptional administrator, but I also view her as a visionary. She sees people in institutions not only as they are, but as they might be, and then she helps map out a path how we get from the present to the future. She's been at Cornell a long time, and during that time, she's shown herself to be really a fierce advocate for graduate students. So I am, and I hope all of you are really delighted to have her on the other side of the Ag Quad. We're looking forward to seeing under her leadership what the graduate school and all of you and students can achieve over the next 5 years. And I do want to mention that Dean Bohr is just one of 4 new deans that we're glad to welcome to Cornell. Lyndon Archer has become the new Joseph Silbert Dean of Engineering. Kavita Bala is the dean of my academic home at Cornell, the Faculty of Computing and Information Science. And taking Dean Bohr's place at Cal, we welcome Benjamin Z. Holton, the Ronald P. Lynch Dean. Unlike our other deans, our other new deans, Dean Holton is coming to us, coming to Cornell from elsewhere. He was at the University of California, Davis, where he was director of the John Muir Institute of the Environment and professor of global and environmental studies. He's a very, very prominent researcher and advocate for global sustainability, and I think we're going to see a lot of really exciting work under his leadership. I also do want to note, because, you know, sometimes we forget, I think, how important our core mission is. We talk about these other things that are also important, and we forget to recognize our core mission. And especially now during the pandemic, as we wrestle with that, we're still seeing really amazing advances in teaching and research and engagement. I could give you tons of examples. I'm going to give you just 2. CHESS, which is our Cornell High Energy Synchrotron source, just received a $32.6 million grant from the National Science Foundation to build a high magnetic field beamline. This is going to support research that can't be done anywhere else in the world. And over at the Institute for African Development at the Mario Einaudi Center, for instance, International Studies, we received a 3-year, $300,000 grant that's going to strengthen African studies and languages for Cornell undergraduates both on campus and in Africa, strengthen our presence as an international university. There's so many examples I can give you, but I do always like to just lead with what's going on in our research and teaching. That said, of course, the pandemic is front and center, and coping with the pandemic has been anything but easy. You, our graduate and professional students, really took on the challenges of this semester with determination and commitment. You voiced your concerns. You worked together to find solutions. You put your time and your energy into finding the best and most effective ways to move forward in this new reality that all of us inhabit. As I said, I'm enormously grateful to each and every one of you. I know all of you are dealing, as we all are, with the personal and emotional stresses of the year, and these challenging circumstances make your commitment all the more impressive. Our infection rate remains very low, knock wood. We've had less than 141 cases of COVID-19 since the start of the semester, and 84 of those were in the first 11 days. To date, about 3/4 of the cases have been students and about 1/4 have been faculty and staff. So these numbers really put us among the most successful colleges and universities in the country in terms of reopening. It's a community success. We are where we are, not just because of the science and database planning that preceded the reopening, but because of the incredible hard work and dedication of our entire community. And in particular, I'd be remiss here if I didn't give a special shout out to our MPH students. They really helped inform our response with surveys and other initiatives. Look, guys, as well as we're doing right now, the success is fragile. I mean, we all read the newspaper. We all know how easy it is for a small gathering to turn into a super spreader event. We've got to remain vigilant. We've got to keep doing everything, physical distancing, testing, daily check, fill out that daily check, face coverings. I am concerned that things are going to get more challenging. You wouldn't know it by today's beautiful weather, but it's getting colder. We're going to be spending more time indoors where the virus is more transmissible. And cases are up in the region, especially in the counties around Tompkins, where many of our faculty and staff live or have faculty. We've seen a small but significant uptick in infections among our faculty and staff population. And of course, nationally, we're seeing numbers rise quite a bit. So we can't be complacent. And I need to urge everyone, hard as it is, limit your travel, limit your gatherings over the holiday. Please do that. I know it's really tough. I haven't seen my old adult children in almost a year. My daughter's expecting her first baby in just a few weeks. I won't be able to go visit her. She lives in Canada and the borders are closed. I would do just about anything to see them in person, but we've just got to hang on a little longer. I hope everybody saw the good news this morning. The science is looking good for at least one of the vaccines, probably two. We've just got to hang on. Surveillance testing will continue after Thanksgiving. And for those of you who aren't on campus often, aren't approved to be on campus now, there's going to be an opportunity for supplemental surveillance testing. And I hope you got the details of that. They went out by email last week. While we're talking about coping with the pandemic, I do think it's worth explicitly noting how much all of us are dealing with stresses and anxieties that we've never had to face before. And at a time when our usual support systems aren't there, family gatherings, social gatherings, childcare, they're not there. If you need more support, please know that CAPS is continuing to provide counseling and other mental health services by telehealth. And for those of you who are out of the state, wherever you are, Cornell Health Services have now been expanded to allow you to continue to receive services, including 24/7 phone consultation for both physical and mental health concerns, non-clinical CAP services, and care management and referrals by phone and online secure messaging without charge or copay. Go to the CAP website and you can get details on all of these. And also on the subject of mental health, I believe you know that the final report of our mental health review has been released. We had said all along we would release it, and it is out there. You can go to mentalhealthreview.cornell.edu. And members of the Executive Accountability Committee, which include Dean Bohr, are going to guide next steps. I know that this is something that Dean Bohr is deeply committed to ensuring that graduate and professional student needs will be addressed. I also want to mention that the improved mental health services for graduate and professional students that we've put in place are just one aspect of the changes that Cornell made in response to the last GPCI, the Graduate and Professional Community Initiative. So again, I owe you thanks. You worked very hard on putting this together, exploring the needs of our graduate and professional students. It's the roadmap that we get, where you let us know what you need to thrive and how we can help you succeed. And because of that, we've been able to identify stressors that are particularly profound during the pandemic and put in place steps that we hope help mitigate them. So childcare grants were modified to expand eligibility and increase flexibility. We set up a downtown COVID testing center because we heard that that was important and would be more convenient for many of you. The graduate student encouraged fields and departments to develop plans to allow students to use offices and other on-campus facilities safely because we heard that many people felt isolated and wanted to be on campus interacting with colleagues in safe ways, especially as the weather turns cold. Sorry, but I told you it's been a while, and I have just a few more updates. But I do want to mention immigration issues, because that's another area where we have been advocating very strongly. It has been an extraordinarily difficult time for international students. We've seen changes in immigration policy and practice that have made things so much more difficult for the students who come here from all over the world. I am personally so hopeful that after this election, with this change in administration in Washington, we will see changes that will create again the much more welcoming climate that we want and we need for our international students. But I do want to tell you, we haven't just sat back and, you know, hoped that the election would work out the way we did. We've been doing a number of things. And the first is particularly important because you can help. On November 2nd, the Department of Homeland Security published a proposed regulation that would replace the lottery system for H-1B visas and instead institute a hard cap. And it would give preference to applications for higher level positions, making it harder for new graduates to get H-1B status for entry level positions. The public comment period is open. We, Cornell, will comment. We urge graduate students who may be affected by the rule to submit comments. If you want to comment, we have talking points we can give you. The Office of Global Learning can provide them. We also commented, Cornell commented on the proposed changes to the duration of status, which was going to, we urged the DHS to withdraw the proposed regulation that was going to replace the current duration of status with fixed terms. This was going to limit students to 4 years in this country. And if they came from countries where a set percentage of students in that country have overstayed their visa, limited to 2 years. Huge barrier, especially for our international doctoral students. So we commented on that. And we have just joined as a plaintiff in the lawsuit Chamber of Commerce et al. Versus the Department of Homeland Security et al. To propose troubling changes to H-1 visas around wage levels and specialty definitions. These changes would have made it much harder to hire international students. There's a hearing scheduled for November 23rd, and we'll report back as soon as we have more information. And all of the Cornell leadership are just committed to doing everything we can to ensuring that our doors stay open to the very best students from across the world, wherever they come from, in any field. That's part of who we are. And on that note, I want to end by sharing some updates on our ongoing efforts to ensure that Cornell is as equitable a community as we can be. First of all, inclusive community-centered public safety continues to be a priority. And as I think everybody knows, we reformed our Public Safety Advisory Committee, the PSAC. It now reports directly to EVP and CFO Joanne DeStefano. It includes students, both undergraduate and graduate, faculty and staff. It has already been meeting, and it is discussing a really wide range of initiatives. Secondly, under the leadership of the Dean of the Faculty, Charlie Van Loan, and Associate Dean Nima Kudva, the Faculty Senate is developing frameworks for 3 faculty-led initiatives, the creation of a center that will coordinate and promote research on the causes of and the ways to address systemic racism and bias. These are topics that a huge number of our faculty have deep interest in and deep expertise in. Second is an educational program for faculty on these same issues. And the third is a 4-credit educational requirement for all Cornell students on this topic. Now, look, I know that for graduate students especially, your experience, graduate and professional students, your experience of Cornell is very much defined by the climate of your own department. So while it's always important that Cornell overall is diverse, equitable, and inclusive, it's also essential to ensure that the day-to-day experience of graduate and professional students with the faculty who are so important to their progress meet that standard as well. And towards that end, there's a lot going on. The graduate school is providing workshops and resources and individual consultations with faculty on equity-based holistic review in graduate admissions. They're developing strategies that focus on faculty mindsets and behaviors, and they're looking at detailed systems and policies and processes and looking at how they can improve them. We've got a number of departments, including SIPS, Information Science, CIS, and more, that have created leadership roles in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Many of our graduate and professional students, especially those from historically underrepresented backgrounds and marginalized communities, have made significant and meaningful contributions to the diversity, inclusion, and social justice work for the university. And I want to thank all of you for that and for helping make Cornell the kind of community we all want to be proud to be a part of. The work can't be your responsibility. It shouldn't be your responsibility. It requires the commitment and the engagement and the leadership of faculty and administrators at every level. but it certainly needs and benefits from your insights and perspectives and your contributions. And so I simply want to end by acknowledging and thanking you for that. And I will open up for questions.
Okay, thank you, President Pollack. I believe we have until 6:30 for Q&A. Q&A is open to all graduate and professional students. Please raise your hand in the participants box if you have a question.
I have a question.
Okay.
How's everybody doing?
I can speak for myself. I think it's been it seems like a very long semester. And I think this has been a very eventful time. And it's strange not to be on campus the vast majority of time. I'm in my 6 year as a PhD student, and I've been essentially in my apartment off campus for several months now. So I think the hardest part is definitely creating the right research environment in a place where, you know, you don't have the same sort of access. So just speaking for myself there, Anyone like to chime in on that point, or if you have a question, raise your hand.
Looks like Akarsha, I can't say her name right, I'm sorry. Akarsha and
Kavya, go ahead.
I just had a quick question. The semester does feel very long, but the next semester is coming up. And a lot of obviously you're aware there was a lot of reopening committees that were working on the fall semester with graduate students working on that, at least one representative. What's the scene for the next semester? Are we reinstating the same committees? Is that going to be a decision that's made by the administration? Do we get input?
The spring, the plan, you know, all the committees that were working on this for the fall, almost all of the decisions that were made for the fall are now going to carry forward for the winter. I mean, decisions about calendar and stuff were set back with those committees. There really aren't a lot of new decisions to be made, so we haven't stood those committees back up. We are very carefully doing epidemiological modeling. I am deeply concerned about what's going on nationally. One of the reasons we were able to keep our rates so low this fall, even lower than the optimistic projections of our epidemiological modeling, was that over the summer when students came back, the rates were very, very low, lower than we had expected on testing on arrival. And I am worried about what's going on nationally. But there just aren't a lot of – we don't need to have those committees because there aren't a lot of new decisions to be made.
Thank you.
I think that Akarsha – and I apologize if I'm missing your name. Please say it for me.
It is Akarsha. You're saying it absolutely correctly.
Okay.
So I just want to ask my president if I can go ahead.
Go ahead. Yes, you recognize. Yeah.
All right. So I had exactly the same question about like what next and what's going to happen with the next semester. I also wanted to add that I know that so many schools decided not to, and we've done it, and I think we've done it successfully to come back and do this in person. And I am just like, I'm grateful that we did it. And I just wanted to say that. That was going to be my beginning statement, and then I was going to ask the same question that Kavya already asked.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, as I said, quite seriously, because I get asked all the time, why have we been successful? And I really think there's two answers. First, we follow the science. We follow the epidemiology. We follow the modeling. We let that tell us everything from whether we had to do the kind of testing where you stick the thing way up the nose or could do it in the front of the nose, to how frequent, to how many quarantine rooms. And second, we just have a remarkable community who chipped in and did the right thing. And you know, everyone said, oh, the students will not. I mean, the students have been amazing. The fact that, you know, so those are the two things. So kudos to everyone and thank you.
Are there any further questions? Please either raise your hand in the participants box so I can see it. I can't quite see everyone at once, so. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. One question about the mental health report, and I know this probably won't get a detailed answer right now, but some of my constituents and I had a shared concern that I wanted to raise. Okay. There's a lot of good things in there. Sorry, I didn't mean to take off. There's a lot of really encouraging things in there. Some of us were concerned, and trust me, this wasn't just myself, about the language at the very end on the last page that seemed to be advocating for a reduction in counseling services. It's literally on the last page in the second paragraph. And again, I don't expect you to have a detailed answer to this right in a second, but for general mental health concerns that do not rise to the level of a diagnosable illness or condition, best practices now often provide for immediate access, and then not providing ongoing access to treatment. And it literally says, you know, have people pay for their, often encourage individuals desiring such care to seek and pay for it on their own. And we were somewhat concerned at this suggestion that a solution to mental health problems is to reduce service or access. So I just wanted to raise that while you were
I do appreciate you raising it. I don't have a detailed answer. In fact, I think I might have missed that line. What I can assure you is that we are deeply committed to mental health, and I can assure you that both VP Lombardi and Dean Bohr, who is on that committee, are deeply committed to doing everything we can. We can't do everything, but to everything that we can to support the mental health of our students, and I know they will take it really seriously. I'm sorry, Tim, that I don't have a more detailed answer because I just don't know the particular sentence that you're referring to.
Thank you. I didn't expect one, but wanted to raise it.
Thanks.
Okay, Ariel.
Hi, I was the graduate student on the committee for the preparation of online teaching, and I was really grateful to be able to represent the graduate and professional student community there. I just wanted to bring up that within my department, one of the issues that's come up is that teaching assistantships are a lot more demanding in many cases than they have been in the past, just because of the added challenges of moving courses online. And I know, because I helped write the report, that one of the recommendations from CPOT was to identify and fund sufficient TA resources to manage increased numbers of sections in the hybrid model. And so I was wondering, I mean, just in our department, it seems like a lot of students have additional TA responsibilities. I'm wondering if that, if the university is sort of keeping track of that at a broader scale, and if there's any plans to like increase the number of TA lines in order to accommodate that need.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's that is something that would be done at the school and college level, and even at the department level, and you know, then they could feed up to the provost for resources. But those sorts of allocations happen at a more local level. I do know that everyone, I mean, TAs, faculty, staff, all of us are working really, really much harder, and I regret that, and you know, we will do the best we can to support everyone. It's not great. I mean, it's just kind of what the pandemic has thrown at all of us. But I do hear you, Ariel. And
But I mean, our TA assistantships do have requirements of, you know, 15 hours a week or 20 hours a week, and many students are surpassing the number.
I hear you. I do hear you. So that you should make sure that your department chair knows about that for sure. What department are you in? Life sciences.
Well, I mean, I'm in plant biology, and I know it was discussed at a faculty meeting in our department. But I'm wondering, you know, if there are university-wide resources for departments to ask for additional TA lines.
Yeah, as I say, it would start at the department level, and it would move up to the dean level, and you know, and then back down. There is not a pool of money right now, which is for more TA lines. There's not any right now. There's not any pools of money for anything, but we will try to address problems as they arise for sure.
Okay, thanks very much.
If I could add to that question really quick. Sorry, David.
Go ahead, Katya, real quick.
I was also going to add, part of, I think, what Eric's question was also about technological needs that have also increased for students who are having to work from home. Mm-hmm. And some question of, if you're a TA coming on campus, you can access some of things like video cameras or recording devices if you need to record for online classes. But there isn't anything available, as far as I know, for students who are teaching from home. And that's something that may be a smaller bit of money, but is equally as important.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I don't, you know, it's an interesting idea, and I don't know of such a program, but we could look into it. But I'm not turning away. I mean, I am turning away because I want to make a note or I won't remember.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Maggie O'Leary, you're next.
Hi. Thanks so much, David. And thank you, President Pollack, for taking the time to speak with us this evening. There are two things that I wanted to put on your radar, I'm sure are not, you know, actionable for you at this moment, and again, are contingent on departmental and college arrangements. But the first of which actually is to add to the previous two points, which is the lack of infrastructural support for this shift to home learning and home dissertating, particularly in my department, especially those of us who are, which is, pardon me, the Department of Literatures and English. That's a huge concern because of the lack of on-campus office space and because of, you know, sort of other demands on our labor and our salary, right? This shift, you know, things as simple as having a desk, right? Having a comfortable office chair, having, you know, I'm not on video right now because my internet is terrible, but it's terrible because it's what I can afford. The second thing I wanted to bring up, and again, I'm not, I'm sure this isn't sort of actionable immediately, and I'm, you know, if you don't have an answer to this, that's also fine, but I wanted to put this on your radar and to make it, you know, to make the issue clearer. You know, all graduates who are on the student health insurance, which I'm, you know, venturing to say is a majority of us here, our prescription service was interrupted over the summer. And I'm aware of at least four people who dealt with serious interruptions to their supply of necessary medications, myself included. And the cumulative loss of work that change affected, you know, is in the area of 4 to 6 weeks. So that's something I wanted to put on your radar and something that's...
Okay, I didn't know anything about this. I'll have to look into it. I didn't know anything about a prescription service issue, but I will definitely look into it.
Yeah. Yes, and that's all I had to say. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next is Liz Davis-Ross.
Our new trustee.
That's right, you're our new trustee. Congratulations, by the way. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Hey, again, thank you for being here, President Pollack. I know this question may not be super relevant to the conversation we're having right now, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I was just wondering if the administration or Cornell in general has had any conversations about further supporting the Ithaca community in light of the pandemic and also in light of just like this social and racial unrest that's happening here on the ground.
We are always trying to support the community. The thing we did most recently was to provide $160,000 worth of testing to the public schools so that all of the students could get tested before they went back to school. Earlier in the year, we contributed to a fund, I forget the name of it, but it was a fund to help bolster small businesses in town. We are limited in what we can do. I mean, the source of our, you know, the more money we give to the Ithaca community, the less money we have to support all the things students want on campus, the less money we have for financial aid. But we certainly do try to be good neighbors as much as we possibly can. I have about 1 minute. I unfortunately am going to have to go because I have an Ivy President's meeting to discuss winter athletics after this.
Okay, do you have time for one more question?
One more question.
So the next person in line was Camilla Steubenberg.
Okay.
Hello, and thank you. One point, one question. Firstly, again, reiterating, thank you for this bold and informed decision of opening up. I teach in person. I myself am extremely grateful to be able to do so. I intuit that my students are happy about sort of some reality as well. And sort of on an optimistic note, I would be curious that say the vaccine is available in the not too distant future, sort of how could we sort of segue back into normality, say that happens halfway through the spring? Yeah. What sort of the best case
scenario? Yeah. So look, I am actually, especially after this morning's news, if you read those news reports carefully, they were very careful in what they reported. So I am increasingly optimistic that we will have a vaccine. But look, it's going to take a while to manufacture it. The Defense Act, the Defense Supplies Act. What's the name of the act that Trump refused to use, but that I'm optimistic Biden will. I'm not going to think of it on the fly, but you know what I mean. He says, okay, you've got to manufacture a lot of this, right? Right now, they're saying they'll have enough doses for 10, 20 million people. Defense Production Act, maybe that's it. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my best guess, and this is a guess, an educated guess, is that we're not going to see people begin to be vaccinated until early next year. And the priorities are going to be for elderly people, first of all, for frontline workers, as I think it should be, then for elderly people, then for people with pre-existing conditions, and then for the rest of us. So we should be so lucky, Camilla, that in the middle of the year next year, in the middle of the semester, we're able to pivot. My big hope is that we can do a live graduation next spring. I'm hoping we have enough people vaccinated by then. I think, you know, Cornell was bold in opening, and everybody's been bold in doing what we need to do. And I think we're going to need people to be bold in going back and saying, look, we know what it means to hang out with other people. We know what it means to be in the classroom with other people. We're not going to be afraid. We're going to get vaccinated. We're going to look to the science. And when the science tells us it's safe to do it, we'll do it. And just like I was one of the first to put on a mask, I'll be one of the first to be back in because I trust the science. You guys.
On that note, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Take care. Yeah, graduating in person would be amazing. I agree. Take care, everybody.
All right. Okay. So we're now going to move on to the next order of business for today, which is elections of the chair of the Student Advocacy Committee. This was proposed, I think, the past two meetings, and the chairship remains open. I won't, for the sake of time, I won't reread the description, but you can pose a question if you have any questions about it. But would someone like to make a nomination? You can speak out or a self-nomination. Okay, so seeing none, this election will have to carry over again into the next meeting. If you are interested in the position, you have questions about it, then please get in contact with anyone on the executive committee and we can try to fill you in on the details of what kind of work involves and things like that. Okay, in that case, we'll move on to the following order of business, which is new business. Does anyone wish to bring any new business before the assembly? Nick, do you have a motion?
Yeah, I'd like to motion to allow UA President Logan Kenny to speak.
Okay. Logan, do you wish to speak?
Sure. And I'll correct that it's UA Chair. I don't know who named me, so I'm just going to quickly change that. Thank you for recognizing me. So it came to my attention today that a resolution came through the GPSA and that another constituent group came and spoke. And I just wanted to speak to the GPSA as a professional student and say that any issues that come before you are within your realm. Anything related to the code, especially as someone who's been working on the code for 3 years, affects you deeply as well, because our peers are found responsible under the code as well. And I just wanted to make a general statement about us all respecting shared governance and being at each other's meetings and not necessarily speaking against resolutions in which the GPSA has brought to the floor. Just as I would say to the Employee Assembly, the Faculty Senate, and the Student Assembly, I think that we each have our own role. And as members of the GPSA, I think that our role is to think about the graduate and professional students as well as the entire campus as a whole. But at the end of the day, we're all here representing graduate students. And I just wanted to say that because it came to my attention that there has been a lot of cross between other constituent groups. And I think that that's appropriate to be had, but I want the GPSA to keep in mind that we're representing graduate and professional students at the end of the day. And other concerns can also be brought forward to the UA, and I'm happy to answer any of those. Thank you.
Okay, so maybe we can have further discussion on this during open forum, but thank you for speaking. Does anyone else have any new business to bring before the assembly? Ariel.
Yes, I would like to bring up a new resolution. Do you mind if I share my screen?
You may. Do you have the privileges, or do I need to give that to you?
I think I have the privileges.
Here. Okay, go ahead and share your screen.
Okay. So this resolution would be to enable prizes for events to be purchased with GPSAFC funding. So essentially right now we have a lot of groups that want to give prizes for events such as virtual trivia nights. However, our current Finance Commission guidelines explicitly prohibit that because gifts and trophies are prohibited. So we cannot currently approve groups' requests to give prizes at in-person and virtual events. So this is attempting to change that. Unfortunately, we still can't allow gifts of money or gift cards because those are counted as taxable income, and there's a whole like paperwork trail that would have to be done for that. And so the only things that will be allowed are going to be gifts or are going to be prizes that are not cash or gift cards. But I still think that allowing groups to be able to give a prize to the winner of the trivia night will make events more fun. And it's also something that several groups have been clamoring for. And to me, it seems pretty non-controversial. So basically, yeah, the line in the funding guidelines under the prohibited items section will be changed from gifts except for speakers or trophies to gifts except for speakers. Note that items of under $75 in value that are not cash or gift cards may be given as prizes for events.
Okay, thank you. So this would then be resolution 4. Is there a second to this resolution?
Second.
All right, it's been seconded, so we will now enter formal discussion. Would anyone like to speak in favor or against this resolution?
I can't raise my hand, but I wanted to.
Okay, Kavya, go ahead.
So this is, I do have a question, but I can wait till later. But I do think I've heard of many groups talking about this, so I think it can be a really important thing to pass. I have one clarification. I don't know if I should wait for that or not.
So let's hear. Would anyone like to speak in favor or against it first before we have questions? All right, seeing none, let's move into general discussion. You can pose a question to Ariel.
So for me, just confirming that this would carry over and it's not just, I mean, I know the pandemic has caused this to be a more salient issue, but it would carry over even after, just confirming.
Yes, we are proposing permanently changing the guidelines.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any further discussion? So I think at this point, I'd like to say that I have to apologize for a mistake I made in previous interpretations of the bylaws. And as it turns out, any vote on a new resolution does require a postponement until at least one meeting following the one in which it's introduced, which would be this one. So under procedures, it reads the resolution would be immediately postponed until the next GPSA meeting. This can be overridden by a two-thirds majority vote of all seated voting members, at which point formal discussion of the resolution would continue. So I apologize for that. I think because I was looking at the wrong version of the bylaws, I didn't see that. So I will consider motions to table or postpone this resolution until our next meeting, into which point we can vote on it, or we can I can consider a motion to suspend the rules and have a vote. So would someone like to make a motion to that, either effect?
Could we motion to suspend the bylaws and have a vote on this, given that it's relatively uncontroversial and would affect groups' funding situation next month?
Okay. Is there a second to suspending the rules?
Second.
Okay. Hearing no objections, then the rules are now suspended, and we can consider a motion to the previous question. So is there a motion to vote on the resolution?
Am I allowed to make a motion to do that as a non-voting member?
I believe it has to be voting members to do this.
I motion.
Motion.
Okay, there's been a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, so hearing no objections, we will now vote on resolution 4, enabling prizes for events to be purchased with GPSAFC funding. All those in favor, please click yes. All those against, please click no. All abstentions, do nothing. And remember, the same rules apply as last time. We need 13, which is the absolute majority for something like this to pass. Because there should be 17 total voting members here today. Okay, so do we have 13 now? I can't say who voted for what. So it's just voting members. Okay, with 13 in favor and none against and 4 abstentions, then the resolution passes. Oh, why do you go down to 12?
I clicked off yes because you said the number.
Okay, you already cleared it. Okay, so the motion passes. Is there any further new business? Right, seeing none, we will now move into the next part of our meeting, which is division breakouts. Could we please, could Wendy or please put everyone in their proper breakout room so we can, and remember what I said about there are 2 vacant voting member positions. This is the time where you can fill those in your divisions if you, by whichever means you choose, whether it's an election or just by discussion. I know there's a vacant voting member position in physical sciences and another for the master's in engineering field. So now will be your time to do that if you have nothing else to discuss. Otherwise, voting members are in charge of leading the meetings. Okay.
Quick note. Sorry.
Yes.
I know this was before. I was trying to get this for new business. But just looking at the vote again, could we have a motion to reconsider the previous resolution? Just because I'm not sure. I feel like people got added in after, so I'm a little unsure of the vote. So
is everyone still okay? We didn't put anyone in their breakout rooms yet.
No.
Okay, so there's been a motion to reconsider. Is there a second to reconsidering?
Second.
All right, second. Are there any objections? Okay, seeing none. Let's have the vote again on resolution 4. Please click yes if you are in favor. No.
Reconsider for resolution 3.
Right. Is it resolution 3? I thought yours was resolution 3.
I think that's the one that caveat.
That is the one I'm asking to reconsider because Ariel.
Oh, okay. So you think that we miscounted on resolution 3?
It feels like people got added in after that. That's why I just want to call for reconsidering.
Okay. Wendy, you have a point?
Just a point of order. The vote was 9-1-7. There were 7 people that did not vote, so those get counted as abstentions.
Yeah. So do you still motion to reconsider the vote?
Yeah.
Is there a second to reconsidering resolution 3 on the proposed stage, changes to the student code of conduct?
Yes. Seconded.
Are there any objections to reconsidering the vote?
Point of order.
Nick, what is your point of order?
I'd like to request that the GPSA speak about this, and graduate and professional students are the ones involved in this conversation as it pertains to them and as pointed out by the University Assembly Chair.
Okay, so is there a second to so suspending the rules and limiting the discussion then to I think I should speak to this. I think this is probably my mistake. I I made an exception to the rules that I let other people who were non-members speak who should not have been allowed to speak under our rules. So I think probably this does not require a any suspension of the rules. Under normal circumstances, only members of the GPSA are allowed to contribute to debate on a resolution. So, and I just made an exception because my understanding was that someone had some information that they wanted to provide to the debate. So, Nick, I will grant your point, and only GPSA members are allowed to contribute to debate on this resolution.
David, can I ask a point of order on that?
Manisha, what is your point of order?
Because it seemed like people did have questions specifically for Kat, if a member asks a question and asks specifically for an undergrad to answer, you as chair can defer to them, right? It's not that they can't ever speak, but if it's like a GPSA member wants to speak to them, they can choose to do that, right?
If we're in the general debate on a resolution, yes, they can, and it's only if the person the question is posed to is wants to answer the question. But when it comes to formal debate, speaking in for and against the resolution, it should only be the members. And I'd like to apologize. That was a mistake that I made earlier on.
Sure. I'm just confused about, like, what reconsidering this resolution, where in the conversation does that put us? Does that mean that, like, GPSA members can't, like, ask a question to them? Or, like, where specifically are we in the discussion hierarchy now?
I mean, so my understanding of the rules is that we should not be asking questions to each other, only to the sponsor of the resolution, right? That's how it's supposed to be working, yeah. But I mean, if there's, you guys want to suspend the rules to allow us to do something otherwise, then that would be the case. But under normal circumstances, that's how it's supposed to happen, yeah. So it's either speaking in favor or against the resolution as a member of the GPSA, or it's asking a question to the sponsor, whether it's of the resolution or the amendment, in which case the sponsor can choose to answer that, right? That's if we're following the rules strictly, that is how it's supposed to go, yeah. Marisa, did you have your hand up? So right now there has been a motion to reconsider Resolution 3. Is there a second to that resolution? To that motion, I mean.
Second.
Or Nick, I think you made that motion, so I need another person to second.
Kavya made the motion.
Kavya made the motion. Okay, so it's been seconded. Are there any objections to reconsidering Resolution 3? Hearing none, we will now reconsider Resolution 3. By general consent, that motion passes. With someone, we are going now into debate on the resolution again. General discussion. If someone would like to speak, could you please raise your hand, members of the assembly? Kavya.
This is more, again, of the point of order, as Manisha said. I'm not fully aware of the bylaws, but if people have questions, because it was a large abstention, which suggests that people weren't for or against it, and that implied that there wasn't enough understanding. So if that requires a motion to suspend the bylaws, that's fine, but I just think there needs to be some kind of discussion about the issue, so people have a clearer understanding. And if they end up against it, that's obviously very fine.
So just to be clear, I think that my understanding of the bylaws is that you can choose to ask questions to the sponsor, but under normal circumstances, all of your remarks should be directed to the chair of the meeting, and they should not be directed at another member of the assembly. And so that excludes members who are people who are not members of the assembly. Nick.
Yes, thank you. I think it's very important to talk about what happened and why there was a misunderstanding here. I think it's really important that, one, we don't allow interference by other assemblies in the autonomy of the graduate and professional student assembly. The most important thing here, shared governance, is a really important thing at Cornell, and I think it's extremely important that we uphold those ideals. Moreover, I think it's important to hear the opinions of the JCCs, which are the most directly involved graduate students in this. As such, I'd like to yield my time to Marissa O'Gara.
So yeah, there is no time to be yielded, so I was going to call on her next, but yeah, go ahead, Hannah.
Hey, Nick, I was wondering if you could share your screen with the resolution and kind of go over the main points and why this is important to pass again.
Yeah, absolutely. I just need to pull it up. Okay. Okay, and also we passed the amendment to remove this part here, so I'm not really going to dwell on that. I think it's important that we pass this because, as was pointed out in the previous debate, even if it's 10 graduate students that get affected by this, it still means that it is 10 of our constituents that are affected by this. And as the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, I think we have a responsibility to represent these students. Nothing that I'm suggesting here is insane. It's literally in line with any legal judicial code that's been adopted anywhere in the world, including in other universities. What we're saying is that the defenders should be independent of the prosecutors. What we're saying is that the burden of proof shouldn't be lowered because 90% of people are found guilty anyways. And in the vast majority, I recall 95% being said it is or more, it is the university versus a student and not a student versus student. So really what this resolution tries to do is only purely advocate for students, specifically graduate and professional students, which are the students that put us in this office. I went over most of the points, I think. It also recognizes the JCCs for their tremendous amount of work that they've done here. I think it would be good to hear from them as well. But I also think that if there are any specific questions about any particular points that you think I should clarify further, I'm happy to do that as well.
Okay, so thank you. We're still in general discussion. Would someone please, would anyone like to speak in favor or against the resolution, who are members of the DPSA? So Hannah, is your hand still up?
No, sorry.
Okay, if not, we will go into formal discussion. Would someone like to make any amendments or have any questions directed to Nick, Tim?
Sorry, I actually hit that right before you switched to formal discussion.
Can
I
just... it's okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I think one point, too, that's worth remembering in all this is that what I'm speaking for, I think this is a good idea to pass it today. And part of the reason for that is that what we pass today isn't the final policy. This is passing something that we are advocating for a certain set of changes, but the people that make the final policy are, you know, balancing the needs of different stakeholders is the job of that group. And it's not that what we pass here is necessarily going to be the final version. And so insofar as I think if there was any hesitance to pass anything because it seemed like, well, maybe this is a good idea or a bad idea for like specific individual bullets, I think if we agree that the bulk of this is a good idea, other, you know, we're not creating the final policy today. And I think that's worth remembering in terms of choosing to vote on this. And I think it's worth advancing some of the critical points that a lot of people do seem to agree on. Because the other things are going to be hammered out regardless. So I just wanted to say that.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion? Jeff.
Quick point of parliamentary inquiry. The one where I'm asking for how things are done. Is it possible for me to ask questions to the JCC, if they're here?
So if the JCC is willing to answer the questions, then I will allow it. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I think given that the JCCs have, I know that they've previously mentioned it in their presentation in the last GPSA meeting, but I think maybe providing a little bit more clarity onto this resolution as well, as to their perspectives on the resolution, and just so that I can get a better sense of all the different perspectives in going into this vote specifically.
Would the JCC like to answer that?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that question. I wasn't there at the beginning of the meeting, but I just want to clarify that everything that we're advocating for within this code is based on feedback we've heard from the hundreds of undergraduate and graduate students that we've advised and what they have told us their interests are. So when we're advocating, for example, for the clear and convincing evidence standard, that's because a lot of students feel that they've been wrongly accused, and implementing that standard will ensure that they have access to a fair process. when we advocate for students have a right to ask questions verbally at their own hearings. It's because they feel like they have a lot at stake, and they've told us that that's an important right from their perspective to make sure that whatever the outcome is one that is reliable and they've had a full opportunity to participate in. So this isn't the JCC's priorities. These are based on the interests of the undergraduate and graduate students that we serve. Happy to answer any other questions that anyone might have.
Thank you. Cody, you were recognized.
Yeah, so since we're going back into discussion, and now Logan is here, who was much more involved in the actual discussions that were taking place in the UA for this. So I was wondering if I could just ask her to comment on my previous statement, which was that it feels to me that the section, the second whereas statement is a bit off base in terms of how, like the amount and sort of time of different sorts of feedback and public comment periods that have been available on this. But. So yeah.
So your question is directed at Logan. Yes. So Logan, would you like to answer that?
Sure, but would it be all right for me to look at the language that we're deliberating? I can properly comment on it.
All right, go ahead. Yeah, Nick. Okay.
It's this line 10.
Yeah, that's right. That's okay. Right.
Okay, so as to this, it's correct that only one public forum was organized, that the incorrect Zoom link was an issue. I think there was about a 30-minute delay, but somebody could correct me if I'm wrong because I was unable to attend it. And public comment was open for a longer period of time. However, I can't say off the top of my head this last statement, but based on notice, I know that there was less, like an official email was sent out at a different time period, but I, without pulling it up, I can't say that it's May 5th.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? David Kent, is that a hand or no? No? Okay. Is there a motion to the previous question in voting?
Motion to vote.
Is there a second?
Second.
Are there any objections to voting now? Or seeing none, all voting members, please click yes if you are in favor of this resolution, so amended, and no if you are against it, and abstentions, please don't do anything. Okay, so with 10 in favor, none against, and 7 abstentions, the motion does not pass and this resolution fails. So unless there's any further motions pertaining to this, we'll now move, it is now approximately 7 p.m. Is there a motion to either adjourn or to extend the meeting time?
Point of order, I took attendance already.
All right, you already took attendance. Okay. Is there a motion to adjourn or to extend the meeting time?
Adjourn.
Motion okay, to... so there's been a motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Second.
Seeing no objections, then the meeting is now adjourned. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.